Earth below us, drifting, falling, floating, weightless, calling, calling home.
Welcome to episode 35 of our Planet Earth series, in which we look at our home planet. Now, for our next story, don't bother looking at the website of the Australian Space Agency. It's just not there. But we've got this from Innovations Australia. And under the headline, NASA partners with Australian Space Agency on Earth observation, they say, NASA will partner with the Australian Space Agency on Earth observation following Treasurer Josh Frydenberg's $1.2 billion funding of the Australian National Space Mission. The Australian Space Agency and NASA signed a joint statement of intent today, and they did this at a conference in Colorado. In last week's budget, the federal government set aside $1.16 billion over 15 years for the Earth Observation Mission. The first phase of the National Space Mission involves the design, construction, and operation of 4 satellites. Potential areas of cooperation were highlighted in the statement, and that included the potential for the Australian satellites to assist NASA's Climate, Absolute Radiance, and Refractivity Observatory Pathfinder, which is otherwise known as CLARIO PF. And to help provide a better understanding of the Earth's climate system, the mission will take measurements of reflected light. Also included in the statement was an acknowledgement that future space collaboration would also involve the United States Geological Survey and Geoscience Australia. Also signed was a deal between Gilmour Space Technologies and LATConnect 60 to launch microsatellites in a planned high-resolution hyperspectral imaging constellation. The 8 satellite constellation will be owned and operated by Perth-based LATConnect 60. Gilmour Space will develop the first 100-kilogram HyperSite 60 satellite on its G-class satellite bus and launch it in the fourth quarter of 2024 using Gilmour's Eris rocket from the Bowen Orbital Spaceport in Queensland. So that's just hot off the press, an agreement signed between NASA and the Australian Space Agency. Well, now, sea level rise and flooding. Well, John Englander is the executive director of the Caribbean Centre for Rising Seas. And he has these comments about sea level rise.
Next, our guest speaker, John Englander, will talk about rising waters for time horizons. John Englander is the executive director of the Caribbean Centre for Rising Seas. He's also an oceanographer, climate consultant, and author. His most recent book is titled Moving to Higher Ground, Rising Sea Level and the Path Forward.
I want to talk about rising waters, which is, of course, one of the big risks that we're all concerned about these days. I want to talk to you about it from a slightly different perspective of 4 different time horizons. When we accumulate data, and particularly the kind of precise data that NASA and many of the cooperating organizations involved here use, we're really doing it to get knowledge. And of course, the ultimate purpose of that is to add to public safety. In the sense of flooding, one of the things that we need to keep in mind is that we're both dealing with short-term flood events and risks, but also long-term designs, because the world's changing rather quickly. Coastal flooding is often described as a problem, but I would suggest respectfully that we really need to think of it as 6 or 7 different problems. There's storms, which is the obvious thing, like a hurricane or typhoons in the Pacific. And storms bring waves and storm surge, which gets up inside of canals and waterways and amplifies. But that's all weather driven. Then apart from storms, there's just heavy rainfall. And as the oceans warm, we're getting heavier rainfall, dramatically so in many places, which seems counterintuitive because we're also getting more drought, but those things go together in a warming world. Rainfall, which might be, let's say, 20-some centimeters in a period of time, rainfall can also run downhill to a lower spot. It could be a lower street. It could be down a ravine, a valley, down a stream going into a river. Runoff multiplies rainfall. And so when we think about flood water heights, we need to think about storms as being one format or vector. Increasing rainfall is another. And then topography and valleys and waterways will turn that into runoff at a multiplied value to rain. Then there's tides. We're all familiar with tides moving up and down almost twice a day due to the pull of the moon largely. We know that at new moons or full moons that tides are even higher. And more often there's awareness that the lunar tide cycle, an 18.6 year cycle, which adds or subtracts the tides to the level of about 6 centimeters, about 2.5 inches on a regular pattern going up and down over 19 years, or more specifically 18.6 years. And that's manifest these days as what are often called sunny day flood events or king tides. The tides aren't really changing, but the tides are appearing to be higher at peaks because sea level's rising. And we tend to confuse these things because many people often use similar words to describe different aspects of flooding. But rising sea level is different because it's like a drip filling the bucket. It's happening very slowly. And we really only notice it during those peak high tides, which are getting higher over the kind of mysterious cycles of tides, which follow the moons and the 18.6 year tide cycle. So all of those five flood factors have different magnitudes, different recovery times, and we'll talk about them in a second. And then there's coastal erosion. And often flooding is confused in terms of terminology with erosion. I said that there are 6 or 7 kinds of flooding, and it's useful to have more specific words like these storms, rain, runoff, tides, sea level rise, and erosion. And another one that some of you may be aware of is tsunamis. And in fact, more and more places are posting tsunami warning signs for evacuation or enhancing the tsunami warning system. Tsunamis would be an entirely different kind of flooding, along with earthquakes, because they're typically driven by earthquakes and are really outside the format of these normal 5 flood factors plus coastal erosion. So just that's from terminology, both to understand things better. Storms are well known and well understood. We're familiar with storms, but we're also seeing these king tides. And it's happening more and more where it's flooding the streets. And that street's been there for over 100 years at that elevation. And it has not had subsidence or uplift. In other words, the level of that street has stayed fundamentally unchanged in relation to global sea level. But they're having a new problem, which is that at king tides or extreme high tides, the water is breaking over the seawall and causing difficulty, salt water, of course. And it's not that the tides are getting higher, it's that sea level globally is rising, and that manifests as higher high tides. So this is just to support my case that we've got to be a little more specific than to talk about flooding, because flooding comes from different things. When I talk about 4 time horizons to think of flooding, I'd like to suggest these. Geologic time, what scientists call the paleo record, is perhaps 10,000 years or longer. Thousands of years. The observational record starts in 1850, going back to tide gauges, and then in 1993 in the more sophisticated satellite record and remote sensing. Then the next time period we need to think about is today and tomorrow, in quotes. And of course, that's the great concern of prediction of what will flooding be in the next few hours when a storm is approaching, or as sea level and other flooding brings the water higher. What do we need to plan for? And that can be a forecast period of 3 hours, 30 days, or 30 years, which gets us to the fourth category. For planning and projection purpose, it's important to think about 30 to 100 years, because that's the design life of buildings and infrastructure. So I think you can see that all four of these time horizons, geologic time is largely irrelevant, except to give us some understanding about what could happen for the future. Then there's the observational record going back 170 years roughly, where we can really look at realistic, accurate measurements, which have gotten better. We use that information to project what's going to happen during the next storm event or during the lifespan of a building, and what do we need to design for and engineer for, which gets us into the planning and projection horizon. If we look at Florida, it actually proves geologically just how dramatic this changes. We all know the shape of Florida today. 20,000 years ago, Florida was 120 some meters lower, sea level was lower, meaning that Florida was twice the size because particularly the western bank was exposed. But 120,000 years ago in geologic history, in the paleo record, sea level was about 7 meters higher, and the exposed land area of Florida was about half the present. So Florida is a good demonstration, although this happened all over the world. To share the concept of sea level change over geologic time, this is since the last ice age about 22,000 years ago, when the ice sheets were at a maximum and sea level was at a minimum. It was 120 meters below today. And sea level rose as the ice sheets melted, not in some straight line, not even in some smooth curve line. There were some inflection points or changes of slope. And then sea level got to the present level about 6,000 years ago, which happens to be the record of human civilization, more or less, which is why we tend to have trouble believing it will change greatly, because it's been fairly stable for a few thousand years. And we'll look at that more clearly in a moment. The other thing I would point out is that when sea level rose quickly, you could not predict what was about to happen based upon the recent past. Now, many of us believe that we're in such an era again, that the recent past no longer predicts the near future. When sea level rose quickly 11,000 years ago, most recently, it rose at the rate of about 5 meters a century. That happened naturally. So it's an important reference point to realize that we really can get to a foot of sea level rise a decade, 30 centimeters. For reference, so sea level rose about 30 floors of a building, that's 120 meters since the last ice age. And if we melt all the remaining ice on the planet, sea level would go up another 17 floors.
88.3 Southern FM, the sounds of the Bayside.
Earth below us, drifting, falling, floating, weightless.
The Space Show, where sea level rise and flooding is the topic. John Englander is the speaker.
And we can see that sea level or global temperature has moved up and down in a fairly regular pattern. We're at a peak of the normal pattern. The difference or the period between the typical global warming or ice age patterns is 100,000 years. That's a natural cycle. We also notice that carbon dioxide move in sync. And the problem is that whereas historically it was the Milankovitch cycle, which is a variation of energy we receive from the sun based upon the elliptical orbit, the wobble, and the tilt of the Earth, which combine into something called the Milankovitch cycle, first documented in 1938 by Milutin Milankovic, and that explains the cause of the ice ages, the up and down variation. It's like a giant summer and winter. Well, so that heating and cooling of 5 degrees Celsius from an ice age to now was happening at a fairly regular period of about 100,000 years. The warming takes about 20,000 years and the cooling about 80,000 years. And it's reasonable to assume that being at a fairly high spot in the normal cycle here, that we probably were turning the corner and would have been entering the cooling phase of 80,000 years to the next ice age. But carbon dioxide shows us the problem, because its normal range was 180 to 280 parts per million, and it's now at about 415 parts per million and moving straight up. Now, what's just, without getting technical here, when the planet warms, the oceans release carbon dioxide. So historically, it was the Milankovitch cycle, this orbital variation that changes the amount of heat energy we get, effectively a giant summer and winter every 100,000 years. When the oceans warm, they release carbon dioxide, and when the oceans cool, they absorb carbon dioxide. So the temperature basically drove carbon dioxide level going back thousands or hundreds of thousands of years, millions of years, actually. But now a different phenomenon has taken over, because it was proven in 1859 that carbon dioxide trapped heat. And as we've changed the CO2 level of the atmosphere quite unnaturally by human impact, that extra heat trapped in the atmosphere is warming the oceans. So they go together over thousands of years, centuries even, but there's a lag time, and either one can move, the other will follow, given centuries or millennia for adjustment. Hope that was clear. Now let's get to the data. If we look since 1850, which is the beginning of the tide gauge database, basically, within reasonably good accuracy, we can get a picture of global sea level rise from the hundreds of tide gauges around the world that were basically pulled into a network. But then in recent times, we've got satellite data, which you're far more expert in than I, many of you. And if we take that in a little more detail, we just hone in on the satellite record, we can see that since it began in 1993 with TOPEX, that the record was about 1.5 millimeters a year. If we look at since the year 2000, the rate is about 3.2 millimeters a year. It's dramatically increasing, more than doubling. And if we look at the last decade, we're approaching 5 millimeters a year in the last couple of years, and maybe too short a window of time to get a definitive number. But the point is, this is accelerating. And as we've learned from the pandemic, it's not so much the number, it's the potential for abrupt change in rate and either geometric growth or even exponential growth that will surprise us. And that's the case with sea level rise. Now, the problem with sea level ultimately is the amount of ice on land. You probably know this, but the ice on land is really in Greenland and Antarctica. 98% of potential sea level rise is in those two places. The rest is in glaciers from Alaska to the Alps. But really, for practical purposes, it's all in Antarctica and Greenland, and it's about 1/8 in Greenland and 7/8 in Antarctica. Greenland's where it's melting fastest. The Arctic does have the Arctic amplification, where more of the heat is going into the northern hemisphere and showing up around the northern region. We think of the melting Arctic, and whether it be the plight of the polar bear and their habitat, or just the fact of more icebergs and sea ice, as the world warms and this polar ice cap disappears, it goes from bright white to dark blue ocean. As that happens, it's one of those feedback loops, because the darker water absorbs more heat, does not reflect like the white ice. But I would also point out a point of confusion. Floating ice, whether it be sea ice or an iceberg, does not affect sea level. Like ice cubes in a glass, and you can run this experiment at home, ice cubes like icebergs are about 10% above the surface. if you mark the level of liquid in the glass with floating ice cubes and let the ice melt, the level of liquid won't change. That's because just before ice or water freezes, it expands slightly and becomes less dense. So as it melts, it actually compacts a little bit and takes up less space. And that's why icebergs or ice cubes stick out of the water about 10%. But as they melt, they have no effect on the level of liquid. It's the glaciers on land that we need to be concerned about. As these glaciers move toward the sea and break off and calve into new icebergs, that's like adding a new ice cube to the glass. That will cause the level of liquid to rise. Also, meltwater from the ice on land melting as the world gets warmer will add to the level of liquid, as you could easily imagine. The third phenomenon that adds to global sea level is land moving up or down, subsidence or uplift. There are many places where land is subsiding, and there's some places where land is uplifting. And that will have an effect to distort the picture of sea level from those vantage points. So in other words, if sea level was rising 10 inches in the last century, but if some place had the land sinking 30 inches, like New Orleans, for example, roughly, it would appear that sea level, when viewed from New Orleans, had risen 40 inches. The 10 inches of global sea level rise plus the 30 inches that the land had sunk. Hope that makes sense. So what about the future? I mean, data to understanding to lessons for our world in a practical standpoint is, I think, what we're most all concerned about. If we look out 30 years and 100 years, within the design life of buildings and infrastructure and even communities, we have to think different, because most data that we're concerned about, from weather forecasts to even longer-term predictions going out days or up to 3 weeks, 4 weeks for long-term weather forecasts, are really important for imminent flooding. But they're not going to tell us anything about sea level rise, because sea level is rising at that rate of about 4 or 5 millimeters a year. When we think about flooding, like what happened in Puerto Rico, or actually we could look at any storm event all over the world, of course, we're not worried about a quarter of an inch. We're worried about inches, feet, or meters, I should say. And in this new era of a warming world, and most of you will be aware that back on August 9th, not too long ago, that the new IPCC report came out and kind of locked in the evidence and the forecast that the world is warming and it's accelerating, and we have very little time to slow it. And to some degree, regardless of what we do, many of the effects are already locked in. So we have to look at the effects of flooding and our ability to project in the near term for weather events. But we also need to start planning infrastructure and buildings that will last at least 30 years. That's a mortgage cycle in most places. And sea level is often mistakenly attributed to the problems today. Now, again, sea level is only rising about a quarter of an inch a year. That rate may have tripled in the last 30 years. But the problem today isn't sea level rise. It manifests with the peak high tides. But we do need to plan for sea level rise, which now could be a meter or two higher this century, depending on how warm the planet is. So that gets us back to why I suggest that we have to break flooding into different kinds of flooding and make sure that when we're combining water levels in the near term to predict a flood that might happen tomorrow or next week with a storm approaching, we're characterizing it properly, because we're barely seeing the effects of sea level so far. But we know from the paleo record, that geologic data, that sea level does change hundreds of feet vertically, which surprises most people to learn. But it's in the geologic textbooks for 100 years, the ice ages. And it goes along with the simplicity of the ice ages. The planet has had natural heating and cooling cycles. But now we're warming it, as the IPCC shows. And as we look to make communities safer and plan for the future, we have to think about these different flood factors. Again, the geologic scale to get clarity, the observational record to see what's happening, looking at the confluence of near-term data to say what could happen in the next 3 hours or 3 days with storms and the need to evacuate. But none of those things will really show us how much sea level is going to rise in the next 30 years or by the year 2100. But I like 30 years. It gets us to mid-century and it is a mortgage cycle. So gathering data is extremely important. Applying it to flood projections is what's vital to people. And we just need to be clear which kind of flooding we're talking about, the storms, the rain, the runoff, the extreme tides, and the slowly accumulating sea level rise. From data to knowledge to safety. We don't have any choice about rising with the tide. The ocean doesn't care what our day-to-day problems are of budgets, architecture, emergency evacuations. But for our generation and future generations, we do need to improve the data, the understanding, and the takeaway lessons so that we design communities that are viable and can thrive in the future. Thank you.
On the space show, that was John Englander, the executive director of the Caribbean Center for Rising Seas. And that has been an episode of our Planet Earth series.
Earth below us, drifting, falling, floating, weightless.
Well, it's time for us to head out of here and hand over to Purple Haze. This has been The Space Show, presented by members of the Space Association of Australia. And you can find us at space.asn.au. So that's space.asn.au to find out more about the Space Association. But coming up right now will be Nick Black, Purple Haze. I think it's Tom Rapp, Pearls Before Swine.
88.3 Southern FM.